The Guardian.
In this month's edition of The Guardian Book Club, John Mullen speaks to the author David Mitchell about his novel Cloud Atlas. When A.S. Byatt reviewed it for The Guardian in 2004, she said it was a roller coaster that we wouldn't want to get off. It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize later that year. In this talk, recorded in front of a Hay Festival audience, David Mitchell discusses the six different stories within the book, how he was planning for there to be more, and the risks of bailing out of a story halfway through. But he began the evening by talking about the inspiration for Cloud Atlas.
I just like to write the things like the things I like to read. And I've got enough faith that there are enough people out there, you, thank you very much, that feel the same, that would also like to read the sorts of things that I like to read. So I don't think about the readership when I write, because that's a dangerous road, because that leads you soon to the question, well, which readership? Guardian-based readership or evangelical Mormons in the state of Utah? Or who? So that's no good. In a way, your question, John's a very sophisticated variation on the highbrow versus the highbrow slash lowbrow question. I don't believe in them. No. There's just a brow. There's just brow. There's a lot of brow. Well, and the only question that matters really is it any good or not?
Yes.
When I read, do you notice the page number? Do you not notice the page numbers? Or do you? And if you don't, that's really good news.
I suppose it's also a bit of an unfair question, because it's a question about readers and whether Cloud Atlas maybe is part of something. And I suppose I do a kind of... I do my sort of bog-standard lecture to my students on contemporary fiction, in which I'm afraid it's a centrepiece.
I'm very honoured to be at the centre of your bog, John.
Well, it's a centrepiece as an example of how perhaps things which once would have been thought rather literary or forbidding become quite accessible. Readers, as much as writers, have been accustomed to all sorts of formal experiments, which once would have been thought, forbidding, and now seem to be kind of inviting instead.
I think that's true. Readers are not fazed by wacko structures. That's certainly true. And it's true that forbidding might be forbidding. I don't know if I'm doing an Emperor's New Clothes thing here. Might forbidding be forbidding because it's not that well written? Sarah Waters' stuff is really damned well written. She could write out the phone book and it would be really, really accessible and well done, I think. So I think both my last two statements might be true.
And what about, I mean, when you were writing them, they have such distinct sort of voices and vocabularies. Did you have to write them on their own, as it were, and put them in, keep them in separate folders in your head?
On my laptop.
Yeah.
Separate folders on my laptop. Yes. Yeah, of course I did. One world at a time is ample, thank you very much. But that's how...
I mean, but did you, and you wrote them through, did you write them through to the finish when you...
Yeah. I found the... quite early on in each of the story's lifetimes, I identified the cliffhanger moment and sort of wrote them backwards and forwards from the cliffhanger moment.
So that the sense of interruption had to be there from the beginning. You knew it was going was going to happen like that. Mm. I mean, you said one of your inspirations for the particular structure was that wonderful book by Italo Calvino, If on a Winter's Night a Traveller, which also has lots of different interrupted stories. But of course, they don't come back. I mean, why was it important that they came back again to you?
Because I really enjoyed If on a Winter's Night a Traveller and felt slightly cheated.
Cheated.
And so I wanted to, what's the verb, to uncheat my readers with Cloud Atlas. Even with what we now call postmodern novels, experimental novels, if they last and if we like them, it's not the jiggery pokery that we really liked. It is actually the old-fashioned meat and potatoes plot and character development in all of them. I think this always has to be true of a novel. Character is created and the writer taunts the reader with the fear that bad things will soon be happening to him or her. I think that's it. I think that's it from...
It is, all your stories
about... Beowulf to Stephen King. Yes. But it's not just me. Yeah. It's... novels that neglect that, they might be admirable in other areas and they may be magnificent formalistic experiments, but really, are you going to run into a burning building to save them, to save the manuscripts? And probably not. It's meat and potatoes, it's plot and character that you run into a burning building for.
So it's funny, there's a connection then, a sort of natural connection between the sort of narrative appeal, because... You put it much more succinctly than I'd ever managed. It's about each story has a central character about whom you fear bad things are going to happen in some way. And on the other hand, thematically, I suppose, the book is about human beings who prey upon each other.
Yeah, yeah. Some writers do sort of... It almost start with meaning and the theme, and that's in the manifesto right at the beginning. For me, it never works like that. I think about plot and character first, and meanings and themes, they hopefully sort of rise up slowly up to the surface where I can see them and then start working with them.
You're kind of risking doing something then with the novel reader by adopting this structure, which was... I suppose that that very thing you've described of caring about the character, what happens to them, worrying about them perhaps, also means that you get us involved. And then you say, now we're going to stop that. And we're going to stop, but not just as in a volume of short stories, we're going to stop it with an ending. And then you're going to have to enter a new world. To be able to do that is an amazing skill, but it also, the reader gets jolted out of all their sympathies. Do you not worry that that was a sort of undoing of the very spell you've managed to cast?
I knew I had about 3 or 4 pages to re-engage the reader really quickly, and that's something Calvino does do. I don't have any time for a nice, slow, elegiac introduction. Come into my new world immediately. I've got to get the reader. Don't go away, don't go away. This is really good too. But yes, it was a worry, and it is a risk. But I felt that I could do it, and I just felt this could be something I'd really want to read if someone else had done it. And that sort of... weird pretense that this is a book being written by someone else that I'd love to read if only it's done well. That sort of dispelled my, Jesus, this could be the end of my career, which I think whenever I hand a book in, as my wife could testify, I'm just impossible to live with for the 4 or 5 days until my editor phones up with so far the good news that that they're not going to send the boys round to get their advance back, which is good news because it's always spent by them. But when you're young, you just don't worry about this sort of stuff. You think, yeah, I'm going to write a 6-parter and it'll split in the middle, and then they'll find the manuscript from before, and then that'll happen 6 times, and yes, that'll be good. And you don't think about it, but hang on, are you sure? Isn't this a bit of a gamble? No, you don't think about it, and I'm sort of... I think you look back at your younger writing days and think, you were so productive and rather bombastic and arrogant, but it's kind of gone now. And I'll sort of spend days agonising over a scene and think, geez, I've got to get this. No, that's no good. Start again. That sort of that fluency that you have in your early days, it kind of goes the more you learn about it, the more you realise how one can be unstuck. In a way, there's a trade-off between artisan-level craft that you acquire only through experience. That's good. That's the good news. That comes. But as that comes, it sort of pushes out, like, kind of, and the little one said, roll over. And what rolls off the other end of the bed is just this, yeah, I'll have a go at that.
Did each of those voices or those six stories, you talk about the fluency of just going for it, did each of them kind of come equally easily? Or was each of them written with equal relish?
It would be great if we had the technology where they can put electrodes here and kind of my mind goes up here and we kind of swivel back to some sort of inner head Google search and I can kind of get it back. Now, I think, thinking back, the first one was tough because first time I'd written any kind of a historical novel and I didn't know how to avoid long-windedness. I was sort of duplicating Melville, which is good. If you're going to duplicate anyone in the 19th century seafaring world, then Melville's a good guy to go for. He can be really long-winded. And I hadn't yet sort of learnt how to, in the words of James Ellroy, skip the bit that the reader tends to skip. So that caused me some trouble. And in the end, I ended up rewriting that quite extensively. The other really tough one was the fifth one, the future Korean clone.
The dystopian, right, yeah.
Couldn't get the language right. And even after it was done, and even when I was on a tour with the book, the two or three times I tried to read from it, it just fell flat. It's impossible to read aloud, that part. Yeah. You've got a clone who started off with a vocabulary of the 200-300 words that she would need to work with in the diary, who's slowly going through this sort of drug mind-expanding process that's called ascension. And she's acquiring more vocabulary now. She's doing this story being interrogated at some point in the future. Can you see kind of we've got a frame within a frame within a frame? What language should I use? What register should she use? One price you have to pay for multiple narrative is it's not only the world you need to reinvent, it's the vocabulary and the language. If you're not really careful, then you end up with everyone sounding like the computer on the Enterprise. You know, this sort of slight metallic, odourless, flavourless way of speaking. So that was certainly the hardest.
Yeah, but it felt like, in contrast, it felt like two of the other particular narrations in it, the Robert Frobisher letters and the Timothy Cavendish first-person narrative, because they are both, as narrators, quite sort of, I don't know, florid, camp, I don't know what the right words are, but they both like using words, and sometimes inappropriately or incongruously, flowery, Latinate, literate words. It felt like they were both done with kind of quite a lot of gusto. I mean, they may have been hard to write, but they were narrated. Both those narrators narrate with great gusto, don't they? Well, I felt they did.
Yeah. A character's relationship with language, the language that they use and what their relationship with language is. Are they confident users? Are they sheepish users? Are they frustrated because they can never find the right words, users? You need to get that sorted at quite an early stage. Write letters to yourself from them, is my advice to aspiring writers in the audience. It's schizophrenia-inducing, but it's helpful and useful, and it's a good way to attack the blank page right at the beginning.
You said you were thinking Melville when you wrote the first section. Were you thinking of anybody or any particular voices when you wrote Cavendish?
A sort of magnified version of my first agent, actually. Who's a lovely, lovely man. He's also got he takes a roguish, luxuriant pleasure in language. That and actually the gynecologist who was present at the birth of my first daughter. It was a really amazing man who's this is a bit pointless because you'll never meet him. But, you know, sometimes you meet someone and you just know their voice has been it's their ace of spades in life, and they've played it, and it's their passport, and they've gone places just because of one of these incredible Richard Burton voices, and it's an Orphean lute of a voice.
Timothy Cavendish goes to a sort of gulag-like old people's home outside Hull. But almost, I think all the rest of the stories take us around the Pacific Rim in some way or another. And, I mean, what about location? I mean, why the particular places?
Not the Frobisher. I've got you there.
Frobisher's not. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, we go to Belgium with
but
him.
The others are right.
Yeah, so what, are the locations anything. Important?
I was just, I suppose, thinking of trying to cover the whole of the, kind of the, you know, the board game Risk.
I do know the board game Risk.
Do the whole board, but I don't know anything about Africa, so that's got to go. I mean, I'd love to be able to write about those countries, but you can't sort of go everywhere in your 20s.
But you went to the Pacific, didn't you?
I went to the Chatham Islands themselves. I had fewer responsibilities in those days. I read about them in Germs, Guns and Steel, that right. multidisciplinary book by Jali Diamond. Sometimes I come across something and you think, if I can't do something with that, then I'm not much of a writer.
Each sort of story seems to have the cliche, I suppose, might be a sort of happy ending. Well, perhaps not the Frobisher story, but a story where our character somehow survives the dangers that we worried about, what you started talking about. And yet the theme seems very bleak, I suppose, that, that the strong... You know, Henry Goose says in the last, quite near the end of the novel, you know, this is the way it works. Henry Goose has two laws, and he says, what's the second... law, and he says the second law is no second law, the first law is the only one.
The weak are meat, the strong eat. Yeah. That's the first law. Really. Yeah.
And that seems kind of not much disproved by anything that happens in the book.
You try writing an uplifting story about being devoured, mate. This is It's a sort of Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, I view the world in quite a bleak way, and Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, I view it in an optimistic way, and Sundays I take the day off. Ambiguous redemption is my favourite. The things I enjoy most end that way. I don't want to be clobbered on the head by a book and just want to shoot myself after reading something. I kind of think, oh, thanks a lot for that. But nor do I want a Hollywood ending. So danger it up.
Well, we've got two microphones.
I just wanted to ask you a question about Black Swan Green, if I may.
Because please do.
It's evidently to a degree a memoir of a very complex and painful experiences, but in it you throw what I see as magical realism. I just wanted to ask whether you felt that a memoir in itself, as fantastically well written as it is, about the nuances of adolescent, teenage relationships with different social levels, wasn't enough, and whether that the magical realism was an element that you felt needed to go in to give it a bit more zing, or whether that really just reflected the way you were as a teenager and as a dreamer, as a writer, growing up yourself?
Oh, good question, thank you. I'm a bit allergic to misery memoirs. They're so miserable. And I felt that, honestly, kind of, I didn't feel my upbringing was interesting enough to warrant a memoir. I can see that sort of if you were born to a wealthy family in Austria and all sorts of awful things happened to your grandparents, and like an event I went to this morning, by all means, that's going to be a great memoir, and I'm sure it is, but... not really. I'm sort of too addicted to photoshopping reality into something I'd like it to... into something I'd like to read. 13's an interesting time. You know, sort of you're no longer able to get away with behaving like a kid, but you don't yet have the adult... You're not yet packing the adult weapons in your arsenal to be able to take on the adult world. It's tough. Horrible being 13. Wouldn't go back. Unless I could go back knowing what I know now, in which case I'd have a blast. But unfortunately, those aren't the terms, are they? It's not in the contract. As for the way you see the world, when you're 8, you're a natural dreamer. When you're 17, you're a natural realist. When you're 13, you're kind of both. Although I won't go on because we're not talking about the book strictly, but I do try to sort of show that these flecks of magical realism, possibly not my favourite term, but these flecks of the fantastic are there to represent the way that when you're 13, a part of you still kind of believes in fairies and a part of you doesn't.
Yes, there's a lady here and then in front.
I wanted to ask you about the comparative impact of being shortlisted for the Booker versus Richard and Judy's accolade. And I also wanted to ask you what you thought about those sorts of prizes and the impact on literature in general.
It's always an honour when you're shortlisted for anything, and I'm very grateful to the people who think my work's worth it. Richard and Judy sold more, would be the bottom line, economically. And I should really call my house sort of Richard and Judy Towers, because they paid for it, and my family and I are appropriately grateful. And if anyone knows them, they're very welcome to drop by for a cup of tea and scone.
Did you ever meet?
Yeah. And they had read the book, I can tell that. as if there were any doubt. But they really had. Prizes themselves, it's a bit of a cop-out of an answer, but in a sense, it doesn't matter what I think of them. They exist, they're out there, they're vehicles for the publicity machine, they exist to sell books, they make me a bit uneasy, because I think of all the great things that never get onto them. When you're one of the lucky few who are in the loop and get invited to Hay, etc., etc., they're marvellous. But they're also a kind of a ceiling that can you see how it works? You're sort of a complete unknown, and it's a bit of a glass ceiling, I fear, for new work, for writers who aren't lucky enough to be invited to Hay. It's a great honour to be on the shortlist. Then it's a roll of the dice, literally 6 judges, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but it's just a roll of the dice. Thanks for your question.
There's a gentleman here. And then a lady here.
Did you always intend to have 6 voices in Clad Atlas, or did you consider a different number at any point?
Sure, thanks very much. I intended to have 9. I wanted 3 in the past, 3 in the present, 3 in the future. I read about a Korean rap star who was one half of a duo called Drunken Tiger. And this really happened. He was sort of involved in a... is involved in a drugs bust, and he went on the run from the police in Seoul and was hiding out, and his girlfriend was a sort of an equally glamorous member of a Korean kind of Spice Girls outfit, and it's a really good story. And he was watching the Timothy Cavendish film on videocassette, and the cut-off point for Timothy Cavendish was where that cassette got jammed, and then we go into the Korean rap star bit, and it would take him a week to work out how to fix the thing, so then we'd start off again. I mean, remember that one? And I got as far as going to Seoul and sort of mooching about the place to fill a notebook with observations about Seoul, and I was too mean and miserly to sacrifice that, which is why this is the location.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's why it's in Seoul, because it cost me 300,000 yen to kind of go there for that time, and I wasn't going to waste that money. The other two stories I can't talk about because I've got not a clue what they are now. They might be swimming around in my notebooks, but I didn't go with that because the book would have been 900 pages. Six times I felt was enough. Nine times is kind of, not a very hay word, but nine times is taking the piss a bit. And if I'm really honest, and this is sort of a, I hope I'm not sort of puncturing any more myths about the artiste, but kind of economics is a factor in the back of your mind, and I'm not ashamed of it. The 19th century novel evolved the way it did because the money was in serials, it was in instalments. The 21st century HBO kind of miniseries is evolving the way it is because the money is in box sets. And this can often be the finest art of any one period. It's influenced by economics. A third of my income comes from translation rights, and translators are paid by the page. 900 pages. An Estonian publisher won't publish it, and even a fairly healthy German publisher is less likely to be wanting to take a punt on it. I'm not guilty. I'm not ashamed of it. It's sort of in the back of my mind as well, as Hilary Mantel wrote in that she writes these reviews and they're brilliant. And I think if I thought of that line, I wouldn't throw it away in a review. I'm not a hobby. But she wrote in a recent review of that Shapiro book about who wrote Shakespeare plays. She said, "A genius is a man who also needs to eat." Isn't that a great definition, a man or woman? So this is another reason why it was six and not nine. Thanks for your question. You heard it first here.
You did.
Well, in that case, it sounds like you need to write a sequel.
The director's cut, yeah.
We
joke about that, but for the e-book, I was sort of asked if there's any, what they call special features that could kind of be included on the e-book, like excised scenes that were really good, just like it happens with DVDs. Now it's interesting, isn't it? Anyway,
I think we've got time for one more. Sorry, there's a lady here. Could you? Thank you. Who's going to ask the humdinger question? Bring the curtain down.
Have we had the amber flash?
We've had the amber.
Okay. Oh, it's the amber flash question.
Yeah, so,
but no pressure.
Yeah.
When you went to Japan in your 20s, I think. Were you teaching English as a foreign language, and is that the root of your total fascination with language?
Thank you. It's one of the roots. So we've got a diversely rooted plant. That would be one. And it's good training to sort of have to explain what us as native Anglophones can order instinctively, kind of the difference between the president's been to China and the president has gone to China, the difference between if I see you and if I saw you and if I had seen you. We all know it, but when you have to explain it, you have to know the mechanics of it rather than just be fluent users of it. That's one. My stammer would be another source of my fascination with language. The endless holidays in Sedbu in Yorkshire, where it would rain and rain and rain, has nothing to do but play Scrabble in the whole place. Weeks of my life have been spent playing Scrabble, just to sort of see, you know, you don't actually stop with words. Sort of words are made of letters, and Stephen spelt with a PH has a different flavour to Stephen spelt with V, and you want to get it right. Maybe and perhaps they're slightly they sort of deflect off the eyeball in a slightly different way, and this is interesting stuff. So Scrabble, it's what we are. We're Homo linguisticus. We are our words, and I love that. Is that the...
That's a great red clump. Light. That's a great clump.
Red light.
I yes, so. I think that's the red light.
The flash question.
Yes, and that's when I say thank you all very much for coming and thank you for your questions. And thank you, above all, to David for dissecting his novel.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.